Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the world headquarters of the Orthodox Union of the OU in New York City, in Lower Manhattan, where we are here together today with the two well-known prominent poskim of the Orthodox Union, Harav HaGaon Rabbi Yisrael HaLevi Belsky, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Torah V'Das, and Harav HaGaon Rabbi Herschel Schechter, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, the two well-known great poskim of the Orthodox Union. And also with me here at OU headquarters is Rabbi Eli Gerstein, who is the OU rabbinic coordinator in charge of recording the Piskei Halacha of our poskim, and my colleague Rabbi Elio Farrell, who works with me daily on the very many continued and consistent OU kosher educational programs that have been brought to the Jewish world in the past year or two. Today's format of the pre-Pesach webcast will follow the following pattern. First, Harav Schechter will give a short discourse on issues and concerns relating to Erev Pesach Shechaliyos B'Shabbos. We will then go on to respond to many questions that have come in during the past several days and weeks. And then Harav Belsky will give a discourse on issues and concerns in Halacha relating to non-consumables on Pesach, including paper goods, toiletries, and the like. It is only appropriate that here at the Orthodox Union, the world's largest and most respected kosher certification agency, where we certify over 500,000 retail goods that you and I partake of every day, that we also extend ourselves to not only produce the certified foods, but to also educate the world at large in kashrus, in all areas of halacha relating to that which we certify. And for that, we're gratified and thank the Ribbono Shel Olam for being given the privilege and the schus. But before Pesach, more than any other time, Pesach, the name itself, connotes Pesach, that our mouths have to be conversant and speak consistently for Shaolim V'Dorshin before the Chag for 30 days, all of the myriads of halachos, of issues, of shailas, of concerns that encompass a whole chelik of the Mishnah Berura in Chelik Or HaChaim. This is the yontif of Leman Tesaper. It's the yontif of Haggadah, of Sipur, of Ki Yishalcha Bincha. And where else should we ask our questions but to the great poskim and those that look after the issues of halacha, big and small, to make sure that all that we do here at the Orthodox Union is accurate and correct al pi halacha. And so we begin by asking Rav Schechter to discuss an issue that is so important this year, more than in other years, Erev Pesach Shechaliyos B'Shabbos.
Good afternoon, everybody. On a normal year, when the Bedikas Chametz is done earlier than Leil Yudalid, the Pesach in the Shulchan Aruch is that a bracha is not recited. This year, because Leil Yudalid would be Friday night, so the Mishnah says that the Chacham moved up the Zman of Bedikas Chametz to the Thursday night before. So this is the exception to the rule. This year, when the Bedikas Chametz is done on Thursday night, a bracha is recited. However, if you do the Bedikas Chametz earlier than Thursday night, a bracha will not be recited. We didn't change the din completely for this year. We just determined that Thursday night is the correct Zman for Bedikas Chametz, and then the bracha will be recited. One of the big issues this year is regarding the eating of Shalosh Sudas on Shabbos. There is a din, we have to eat three Sudas on Shabbos, and we usually assume that the third Suda is supposed to be eaten in the afternoon of Shabbos, and according to the way it appears in the Rambam, the third Suda should be eaten preferably after one Davin's Mincha. But the Shaila is, each one of the three Sudas is supposed to be consisting of Pas, is supposed to say Hamoitzi, Alpi Pashtus. And on Erev Pesach in the afternoon, if you're going to have Shalosh Sudas, you can't eat Chametz and you can't eat Matzah. So how can you possibly say Hamoitzi? So a simple solution that's discussed in Shulchan Aruch is the prohibition in the Gemara against having Matzah on Erev Pesach only applies to matzah with which one could fulfill a mitzvah on Leil HaSeder. But if you have matzah Ashira, which is not acceptable for the Seder, so then the Balei HaTais is saying, the Shulchan Aruch says, that's permissible to eat. You would say HaMoitzi on that, and that would be permissible to eat on Erev Pesach. So the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch writes that our practice is that we don't use egg matzahs all Pesach long. We have a chumrah not to use egg matzahs. So therefore, that possibility is cut out. You can't have shalashudas on egg matzahs. So here's the big discussion that the commentaries have on the Ramah. What exactly is he driving at? Does he mean to say that we have adopted the chumrah not to have egg matzahs unless you have a situation when you have cholim meskenim? If you have a big shasat chak, then we permit the egg matzahs. But for a normal adult who's healthy, we don't allow egg matzahs. Did the Ramah mean to say that the chumrah even applies on Erev Pesach in the afternoon? You're not allowed to eat egg matzahs. So did the Ramah simply mean to say which meshugan is going to bake two egg matzahs to eat on Erev Pesach in the afternoon? That's the way they point out. That's the way the Ramah himself writes in the Darkei Moshe Ha'oruch. He says it's not because the chumrah against eating egg matzahs even applies on Erev Pesach, but rather because it's simply not available. Since we don't eat egg matzahs all the Pesach, so where are we going to get egg matzahs to eat on our Pesach at the Chatzos? So that's why many have the practice that they'll use egg matzahs for shalashudas. If you eat enough of it, egg matzahs are normally mezainis. If you eat enough mezainis, if you kaveh suda on it, you would say, you would wash and say hamoitzi, and recite birchas hamazon on the egg matzahs. There are those who are opposed to this practice of having egg matzahs because the Rambam's opinion is that egg matzahs would be acceptable for matzahs mitzvah. The Rambam states that the matzah ashira, which is not acceptable, you cannot be yotze the mitzvah leil haseder with matzah ashira, only applies if the matzah was mixed with one of the four mashkim that are mentioned in the Gemara, yayin, shemen, dvash, and cholov. But if you have egg matzahs where you have eggs mixed in with apple cider, according to the Rambam, that would be good for the mitzvah of matzah. You can use egg matzahs for the Seder. Now, of course, we don't follow the Rambam's opinion. Not only do we not use egg matzahs for the Seder, we don't even eat egg matzahs all Pesach long. But the question is, maybe one should be machmir for the Rambam's opinion, not to eat the egg matzahs, not to permit one to eat egg matzahs on Erev Pesach, because maybe we should be choshish that's considered matzah that one can be yotzei dechavos. So that's why a couple of years ago, the last time Erev Pesach fell out on Shabbos, some of the matzah companies came up with a new gimmick, and they made the egg matzahs with wine mixed in. So that even according to the Rambam, if you have yain mixed in, so for sure that's a matzah ashira, that's not acceptable. Other people have the practice of simply taking matzahs and cooking them in water, or deep frying the matzahs. And the Gemara says that a matzah mevusheles is not acceptable for the mitzvah because it's, Tosafot says, because it's matzah ashira. Other people will follow what it says in the Ramah, that they'll have the shalashudas after mincha only by having peiros. There's one opinion in Tosafot that one can fulfill the mitzvah of shalashudas but without washing for hamoitzi, by having peiros every Shabbos. If some people do it on a normal Shabbos, and then they should do it there, Pesach Cholis for Shabbos also. The whole medubar over here only is for those who are medaktik every Shabbos to have suda shlisha, some pas, to wash hamoitzi. So how does one take care of that on Erev Pesach? Other people have the practice of having the Suda Shlishis in the morning, even though the more correct way should be to have the Suda Shlishis in the afternoon, and according to the Rambam, preferably after having Davin the Mincha first. But if you have a big Shasat Chak, so then others will have the practice that they'll split up the morning meal into two. They'll say Kiddush in the morning, after they come home from Shul, after Musaf, they'll wash, say Amoitzi, have a half a meal and bench, and then pause, take a walk for 45 minutes, whatever, have a pause, and then have the second half of the meal. That'll be the Shalashudas in the morning. So that's usually assumed to be the big issue. Many people will insist on having chometz on Shabbos morning. Strictly speaking, you're permitted to eat chometz as long as it's early enough in the morning. Then the question is, what do you do with the leftover chometz? How do you destroy it? So the Shulchan Aruch quotes the expression of the Rambam. Rambam writes that whatever crumbs of chometz you have left over, kof all of a sakli, you should invert a pot and leave it until chalamoid and then destroy the chometz. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger, in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, wonders, why does he say kof all of a sakli? If the din would have been that the only way to fulfill the mitzvah of tashbisu, of destroying the chometz, would have been by burning the chometz, of course on Shabbos you can't burn the chometz. The Gemara says that's a malocha. But we don't paskin like that. We paskin la halacha that one can fulfill a mitzvah of tashbisu with hashbasasa b'chaldama by destroying the chametz, not necessarily through burning it. So what's so bad about flushing the chametz down the toilet? So many have the practice of doing like that. They say that Rambam just meant if it's inconvenient, if it just can't do it. And others insist, no, that you're not permitted to, others have a whole pilpul on the Rambam meant to say, you're not permitted to destroy the chametz on Shabbos. It's some kind of a prohibition or another. So there are different practices. Regarding the mechiras chametz, the rabbonim have different practices exactly how to sell a chametz. Rabbi Akiva Eger in his Tshuvas raises the issue that maybe the prohibition with the rabbonim, the isim with the rabbonim against performing mekach memkan on Shabbos, maybe the prohibition even applies in a situation where the person drew up the whole contract, he did the whole mechira, he did all the ma'isei kinyanim on Erev Shabbos, and he states in advance that he wants the kinyan to take effect on Shabbos morning. So that's why many rabbonim will make the mechira on Friday morning, that it should take effect on Friday, on that all of that chametz that will be left over, it will be nizbarer on Shabbos morning, on which chametz the mechira is taking effect, but the mechira will take effect on Friday. And others are of the opinion that that's not acceptable, that that's in violation of the principle of Ein Brera. You want a kinyan to take effect on Friday morning, and you don't know on Friday morning which chametz is going to be included in the kinyan. So you have to wait till Shabbos morning to determine which chametz is included and which not. So that's in violation of Ein Brera. So most others, I think most have the practice, but this is an issue for Rabbanim. Most Rabbanim will use a Shtam Mechira that says that the Mechira's chametz should take effect on Shabbos morning, after the Zman Isra Achila, before the Zman Isra Hanoah. And a minority of the Rabban will be choshish for Rabbi Kiveger's opinion and make the Shtar Mechira in such a way that the Kinyan should take effect on Erev Shabbos in the morning. I mentioned in the morning because the Achreinim have a chumra that when you finish doing the Bdikas Chametz on Thursday night, even though strictly speaking you can eat Chametz all day Friday, you can eat Chametz on Shabbos morning, so the practice is, and Shulchan Aruch says the practice is, that you go to burn the chametz Friday morning, the same time that you would have burned the chametz if it would have been Erev Pesach. Friday is not Erev Pesach. So some achrenim have the practice that the rabbonim should sell the chametz on Friday morning as opposed to Friday afternoon. They should sell the chametz on Friday morning because of Gzeira Otu another year when the Mechiras chametz takes place actually on Erev Pesach.
Thank you very much, Rav Schechter. For all those who are logged in and who have friends, neighbors, and associates who have not been able to log in, the entire session that is recorded here today will be posted within a day or two to OU Radio, where all of the 101 kosher tidbits previously posted are available for your continued learning pleasure. At this point, we're going to go to shailas and questions that have been submitted. A question that came all the way from Alaska states, I understand that granite countertops can be kashered by aghola, so can boiling water be poured on the granite, or must something else be done? I don't want, should, I want what is necessary to do. States the questioner. Rav Belsky?
Actual granite is stone. And we could kasher stone. There was a discussion. Machloikis Rishonim, Rav Haigoin said that stone is not mentioned in the Gemara, and we can't kasher it without gola. But the Rosh says that anything but klicheres, which the Torah has made, the Torah says that klicheres doesn't lose its filth. If something becomes absorbed by klicheres, it remains there. But the granite, being stone, and the other stone, keli, will be able to lose its bliyah. There are a couple of problems with this. One is that the granite that's in use, it's not just a slab of stone that's carved out of a mountain or something. but it does have, in some cases, ground up stone, and it's held together by some, you know, types of glue and cement that makes it smooth. Then they smooth out the whole thing. So it's possible that there are bleas that get into it, and because of that, we should be damned that it's like a klicheres, a ceramic piece of material that can't be kosher. Another thing is that when we have a table, shulchanos, we generally don't rely just on pouring boiling water on it, but we have to have an even melubenis to go along with the shulchan. Mishabiru says the reason for it is because very often we put a food that's a double gush on the table. A double gush is a solid piece of food that doesn't lose its heat when it's transferred to a kelu sheni. And it does more than create the bliya of a kelu sheni or even iru kelu rishon, which requires hagola. It may be treated like a full-fledged kelu rishon, and it would need a full hagol, and not just an iri, not just pouring boiling water on it. He says, therefore, the minhag is to take stones which had been sitting in the fire for a while, hold it by a pliers, and you should go back and forth with the stone, following the stream of water that's coming out from the pot of boiling water. So there should be a combination of both iri, mayim yoschin, and also the use of an even melubenis to provide that additional heat. You got to keep changing the stone because it's self-understood that after a minute, or much less than a minute, the stone will lose its heat. So we have a double question. Is granite something that's a pure material, and could it be kashered at all? Maybe it's just a combination of many materials, cement-like, and therefore it can't be kosher. It seems that the general attitude of people since granite came out is that since the bulk of it is just the stone itself and not the other materials, so we could rely on the granite to be treated like a stone, a pure stone, and kashrut, but we would need irui together with an even melubenis, which is quite difficult. And in all fairness, when a person generally has a private kosher kitchen, it should be like the custom was throughout the generations to cover it with some material. We have aluminum foil, we have those cardboards that were very often in common use, or papers, heaven papers of some sort. But you should do that rather than go through a tremendous amount of preparation and at best have some suffix, because it still may be not the pure stone itself or it's so distant from the pure stone. What do you gain? You gain having a countertop that you could use without covering it and taking away from that very special feeling of a Pesach kitchen, which you have your shulchanos covered up, which would be a little bit better.
Very much related to this question of Belsky, you almost alluded to it. The gentleman asks, is it really necessary to cover your formica countertops with paper? Is it possible not to use for 24 hours prior and then just wash them well with a bleach or a Windex-like solution?
It's very similar. The formica is a plastic, and we do kosher plastic. Most poskim said that Moshe had two tshuvas. First he said he was stupid whether you could kosher plastic, and a later tshuva, which seems to be an accurate one, he said that he finally decided that you could kosher plastic. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal said that you could kosher plastic. It's generally been the practice to kosher plastic, so you could kosher formica. But you know, there are so many things about it that require a little bit extra. There's usually that metal trim that the food becomes trapped in. and there's a splash pot in the back, which you never get when you pour boiling water over it. So it's a good thing to pour boiling water over the formica. And if it was a treif in the kitchen that you got from Goyim or people that didn't keep kashrus, so you could rely on it. But for Pesach, as I said before, it's preferable to do the customary thing and keep it covered. After all, there's so many different situations. And if a person figured out some very special method of being able to use the countertop without kashering it, so others who see it would probably try to duplicate what he's been doing and use their countertop without kashering it. And surely a michshol would come out that the countertop should be covered.
Since we've begun, I'm pleased to also welcome to our headquarters here my chaver, Rabbi Yosef Grossman, who many of you know is deeply involved also in extending OU educational programs to the yeshiva world, to various communities. Recently, there's been an enormously successful NICOR program in Lakewood. Other sessions that Rabbi Grossman coordinates in Yeshiva Torah V'Das, Tiferes Yerushalayim, and elsewhere, and it's a privilege and schus to work with him as well. We turn now to some issues relating to the Seder, and issues relating to the actual observance of Hilchos Pesach. My colleague asks, when we say that one can consume water after Afikoman, does that include a heter to drink Coca-Cola, drinks soda drinks, which some say has the halacha of water regarding tziruv to a zimun? What about coffee or tea? Rav Schechter?
I think Coca-Cola is improper to have after Afikoman. There is an opinion that one may drink anything you want after Afikoman, but that's not the generally accepted opinion. We assume it's not proper to drink only water. Tea is, and Mishnah Berurah says that tea is okay.
Is there a preferred green vegetable for karpas?
Some want to demonstrate that banana is very prehadamus, so some people use banana. Some people use potatoes. The Magen Avraham says you should use a green vegetable because the Mishnah says yerokas. A green vegetable should be something that you would normally say hadama on. If you use parsley, so that's traditionally people use parsley, that's a little questionable because normally when you eat, people don't eat parsley. So it's questionable whether it's hadama. In our family, we usually use celery.
Rav Schechter, one of our colleagues also asked as to what is the actual definition of kitnios.
Rabbi Belsky would know that better than me.
Well, kitnios, the word kitnios means peas, pool means beans, but there's really no difference. The minig to be machmer in kitnios is mentioned in the Mordechai, in the middle generation of Rishonim, nobody knows precisely where it began. But in all the kilos of Ashkenaz, the minig is not to eat kidneys on Pesach. What exactly is kidneys? They say it's anything that could be ground up and turned into a flour, which could be used in a similar way to wheat and barley to the Chamesh HaSaminim. Another thing is that they have its seeds which look similar to wheat or to the common grains. Another thing is a type of vegetable where there's a cleaning process called digun. Digun is something that we find in the Pasuk. Dogun, it means something that there's a process called digun, or maybe it's the other way around. Once it's called dogun, so we call the process digun. Whatever it is, it's a process which begins with disha, banging it and breaking apart the shell and the stalk from the seed, and then winnowing it like they did in the old days to allow the wind to carry off the lighter chaff. That's digun. precisely what kidneys ends up being is totally in Minhogin. Everyone was not to ask the common beans, and rice, and mustard seed, their mo brings especially. And as far as other things, there are chilukidayas. American corn, which is a new vegetable which wasn't around at the time of the original minig. Havel Pekin, it seems that it was accepted that corn is called kidneys. Peanuts is something that there was always a matter of dispute. Peanut oils, there were famous in Europe with the Gilles Ashkenaz. Did use peanuts. Today, it's almost universal that peanuts aren't used. And so on. There's been a grain called quinoa, which is subject of a lot of discussion. People print in their publications that quinoa is definitely not kidneys. It's my opinion that quinoa is definitely kidneys, because it has all three attributes. It's ground up and made into flour, which is used in a similar way to grain flour, produces bread-like food, and the seeds are similar to grain seeds, and it's clean through process, although not precisely the same as the digun of grain. But look, whatever people will end up doing, the minig will become the halacha when it comes to this grain. Every now and then there's a different seed that's either added to the list or in dispute, like cottonseed oil. Here in America, we always all use cottonseed oil. There's no shiloh, no dispute whatsoever. There's no reason to be machmir. But Eretz Yisroel, there were some poskim that said a number of years ago that cottonseed oil should be considered kidneys. So, it'll matter in which country, in which location the shiloh is asked. And every now and then, there's something else. There was even a question of considering potatoes to be kidneys until it became apparent that there was an alternative. It's the only food that could be used on Pesach. So that shiloh, that suggestion, was put to rest.
Belsky, one of our rabbonim had a consumer ask him, related to what you were just discussing, I am Sephardi and eat rice and beans, etc. For me, Pesach is easy. Which precautions, if any, must Sfardim take to assure that their kidneys are not made on kalim used for chametz, or may even have some traces of chametz, such as fortified rice?
I hope that the right people are listening to this, because we've tried for a number of years without much success to have a hashgacha done from the OU, and you offered to do it without me. Any profit to themselves in any which way, cost free to have a hashgacha on kidneys done for Sfardim. Because just when a thing has beans or rice, there's usually no good hashgacha on the production of that item. Because the hashgacha is done by Ashkenazim. And so therefore the Sfardi would say, well, we use this product, we use that product. In reality, you can't use any of the products, because as long as something's processed, there's always a chance that there are the wrong kalim or other ingredients are put into it. We would definitely welcome having people cooperating in organizing such hashgacha, but it requires, I guess, a businessmen who are willing to invest money so that they could pay for the production of the product and then distribute it, and maybe they can make a lot of money. But we've not had any cooperation. We went to tremendous length to even get rice, which was unenriched. We had a company that made rice, which, by the way, is in America not so simple. I think the law requires that rice should be enriched, but for a couple of days, Pesach, they agreed that we could have unenriched rice. Most rice, during the changeover, getting rid of the brown shell and what they call polishing the rice, so the vitamins are lost. And the government insist that rice shouldn't be distributed without having the vitamins restored. And the B vitamins, thiamine, niacin, you know, these vitamins are all grain-derived, b'derech klal. And there would be a little bit of chometz in any enriched rice. So we tried to have the unenriched rice distributed to the Sephardic community. And the end is that they refused to eat the rice we prepared for them because they liked a different kind of rice and were upset that we didn't prepare that kind of rice. So we've gotten no place. I hope that by next year, Be'ez Hashem, we'll be able to do it, have some kind of plan.
We certainly will look forward to any suggestions from Achenu B'nei Yisrael, Sephardi community, to be able to serve the needs of all of Klal Yisrael. Parenthetically, during the webcast, those who want to send in additional questions may do so to the computer email address of my colleague Rabbi Farrell, farrell@ou.org, and it will be brought up to our broadcast room here. We just got email that was brought up, which says, I have a friend in town that has a commercial steamer. The steam coming out of the nozzle, according to the company, is 250 degrees. Is steam a viable path one can take to kosher their stainless steel sinks and granite countertops, Ravelsky?
No. The Moshe has a tshuva. Moshe is a tzaddik l'vrach, has a tshuva about steam. He says that b'derech klal we should try to avoid using steam because we have no source, we have no mokar in the shoinim that says that steam could be used to kasher. He says there are cases where the blia itself came into the kli with steam and will say kavoy l'kach poltoi, and we don't need to do any different than apply the same method that caused the blia. And that method will get rid of the blia, the absorption of the material. So if there was only steam, like in a microwave oven, we could use steam to get it out. This was the psak of Reb Moshe Tzatzal. Reb Moshe also said that if we have the steam floating in there long enough for the condensed wetness that accumulates on the sides of the kli to be heated to the point where it reaches boiling temperature, then it surely should be good, because it's not just the steam that does the kashering, but it's the condensed water that's boiling on the sides of the keli. We have cases where there's mamish no alternative, and we try to fill up very, very large kelim, like storage tanks, huge storage tanks. We try to fill it up with steam if we have no choice, no way to spray it constantly with boiling water. But in the whole, if we have any way to make a hechsher by using hagola rather than steam, it's preferable.
Rav Schechter, how small an amount of chometz in something do I have to sell?
If the chametz was mixed in as an ingredient on purpose by the company, then we assume that even if it's a small amount, we should get rid of it.
Is it a wrong thing to sell chametz gomor?
Rav Soloveitchik used to follow those opinions that it's not proper to sell chametz gomor, but he would encourage not only his students at Yeshiva, he would even encourage the Balabatim to avoid selling chametz gomor. Unless a person has a bakery, so he has no choice, or he has a liquor shop, liquor is also chametz gomer. And then he said, you should make a separate shtar mechira. You shouldn't just sign on to the shtar mechira klali. But most of the rabbonim did not accept that opinion. The author of the Nesivus has in his collection of tshuvas in the Nachlas Yankov, the first tshuvas to the Bechotcha Rav. And he writes that his opinion was accepted all over Europe, that the farmers would sell chametz gomer to the next door neighbor, to the Goyisha farmer. They would sell the cows and sell the chametz and give instruction to the Goyisha neighbor that they should feed the cows chametz on Pesach. So the generally accepted opinion was that it's not a problem. It's a chumrah.
How nishtana does something have to be not to be considered chometz?
Nishtana. Nishtana is a big dispute in Rishonim, whether Anisa Shenishtana becomes mutter or not. We are machmer on Anisa deraisa, we are machmer that we don't rely on Nishtana. The Mishnah Berurah is mekel, and if a case happens to come up, and it's only Anisa derabbanan, and it's a major case, major Nishtana, then we would be mekel. But usually chometz is an issue deraisa, so we would not rely on Nishtana.
Is there any chisaron in removing the kittel for the suda?
We were just discussing before this issue. We both thought that that was not proper, that a person should wear the kittel while he eats the meal. They quote in the name of the Vilna Gaon that the reason for the minig of wearing a kittel is that it's supposed to be a zecher to the days of the Beis HaMikdash when people would go to Yerushalayim. They wouldn't wear their regular suit when they ate korbanos. They would wear a chaluk lavon. So other rabbis, so you're supposed to wear the chaluk lavan when you eat the meal. It should be a zecher l'mikdash.
We're going to stop now for several moments with the questions. And as I announced earlier, Ravelsky will discuss halachic issues relating to non-consumables, paper goods, toiletries, foil, and the like. Ravelsky, please.
Okay. Just a couple of general klolim with regard to inedibles, non-consumables. First of all, if chometz is, if there's actual chometz, it should be destroyed or gotten rid of by selling it to a goy. Even if that chometz is miyuchad to be used as a chair, kaifas seor. A block of sor, which they use as a chair, should be gotten rid of unless it's covered with some tit, l'chatchila. That's as far as Bal Yiroah is concerned. But when you use non-edible chometz, so if it's not pure chometz like the block of sor that I spoke about before, but it's a material which may contain a little bit chometz in it. So it can't be used in a way which you're nene from the chometz, or you have any gain from the chometz. But for instance, if you have a kli that had a lot of holes in it, and you blocked up the holes by applying paste made from wheat and wheat flour and water, which is, by the way, the basic ingredient for wallpaper paste, for any paste. In the old days, the word paste comes from the same shoresh as the word pasta. It means the a mixture of flour and water. And that was used as a glue. And so, let's say we have a keli where there are a lot of holes, and the holes were clogged up by applying a paste to it. It became hard so that it just doesn't dissolve in water, and you could use the cleat. In that case, we're being nene from the chometz when we use the cleat, because we wouldn't be able to hold liquids in it without the clogging up created by the chometz. On the other hand, most of the time the chometz that's there is there for a long, long time, and it becomes a bottle, it becomes like a chalik of the kli. But the shilas that generally accompany inedibles aren't talking about these rare cases. They're talking about something else altogether. Let's say, for instance, there's chometz in pills. Well, medical pills that are needed to be taken to cure an illness or to treat pain and similar purposes. If you, it's einaroy lachila, einaroy lachila sodom, it's einaroy l'ker. In addition, by chometz you need an extra chumra, even if it's not really, but if it's something that could be used to be mechametz isoy sacheres, it could carry yeast and be used as an agent like typical yeast can be eaten. It's still, if it's roy makes a oir, so then it goes into the call of seor. And if it's still possible to use it for that purpose, then we got to get rid of it. We can't use it, of course. But still, this isn't an area where the shilas come up. Let's start with medicines. Medicines may contain some chametz in them. But on the other hand, medicines are inedible. They're bitter. But they're chlal. I'm not talking about liquid medicines. We'll come to that in a moment. But solid medicines, pills, they are not roy to be eaten by anyone, not even by an animal. They're not roy l'chamei aboyisus acheres. And the only thing that one might argue is that when you swallow a pill, so you're restoring it, you're giving it back the status of a food because you're swallowing it in the manner that a food is swallowed. Swallowing is considered to be an act of eating a food. You say bola matzah yotza. If you swallow matzah, you yotza, even if you don't chew it and feel the taste of it. Aval pikein, when you swallow a pill, so you're not restoring it to its status as a food. It can't be called achshave. That's the opinion of most poskim. There's another category called vitamin pills. Moshe Zatzal said that perhaps by vitamins it's really different, because people mostly take vitamins because they feel that the foods that we have today are depleted of their vitamins because of all the processing and the refinement. So therefore you have to eat vitamins to make up for the loss of nutrition in the processed foods that we eat. If that's the case, then by swallowing a vitamin pill, it's really achshavei, because you're treating it like a food. And this is the way of completing the meal. It's incomplete until you take the vitamin. So one should not take a vitamin pill which has any chometz. It should have hashgacha. And if there's no way to get that particular vitamin over Pesach, so you'd survive for it. 8 days without, or 9 days without the vitamin. There's other problems about kalim that people claim that they're infused with chometz. For instance, paper plates, cardboard plates that are used all the time. Some say that there's starch that binds the pulp of the wood, which makes the paper, and gives it that thickness and softness. That's how come the plate looks like it is. So, even though it's an inedible item, still in all, if you put food on it, the food would absorb the taste of the chametz or the starch that's inside the kli. It's the experience of most people that if there's any starch in these kalims, the starch doesn't leach out when food is applied to it, even hot food. People say that paper towels, there's a starch in many of the paper towels. It's the simple chemical test, like putting iodine in it, shows that the starches, if anything, if there were starches there to begin with, so the starch was already bonded to the paper component and can't be released any longer. There's all kinds of components of chometz in edible items. For instance, you have aluminum, kalim. So the simple disposable aluminum kalim are made from a sheet of aluminum, which is on a roll, and it goes through a die stamped out one after another. You see the machines, they give a stamp, one, another one, another one. If they would just stamp the aluminum sheet as they are, they would make a hole in it, just rip straight through it. So, a second before the stamper, does its work. There's a spray of an oily substance to lubricate the passage of the stamping device of the dye and make sure that there's no doesn't rip through, and that's how you get your disposable aluminum pen. So there's always a little bit of oil left on it. The second after they do that, it's ready to pack up and sell and distribute. That's all. It's never, the oil is not removed. Some people make announcements that they should kasher the aluminum pen. If that were the case, then the kashering water where people put their kalim in would all be chometz stick or treif. Why? Because this this oil is on the top of the pan. It's not nivlo inside the pan. It's sprayed on cold. And it's not nice and tamal of gam. It's still meshubach. It's in a good condition. And it would impart the material would melt into the kashering water, and eventually all that water would be the treif or chometz stick. Our experience shows that there's almost never any questionable oils or in the lubricants that are applied to pans. It's usually just plain mineral oil. There are non-kosher oils that are applied to the ingots of aluminum or steel before they process them, before they mold them. It's almost universal. The steel pots, there's mutton fat which comes from sheep, it's all novella. And in the ingots of the aluminum foil before it's turned into a ribbon of aluminum. There's very often tarfa applied to it, but in these cases it's almost always burnt out and destroyed. There's nothing left by the time it's ready to be made into a kli, the finishing touches are on it. It was red hot and everything was burned out and came off. There's always a question about lipstick. You put the women put lipstick on their lips. So, of course, it's nothing more than a cosmetic. It's not meant to be a food. And it's not the royal achila. So perhaps even if it's chometz and you can't have an offer from it, there should be no problem. Because it's like a cosmetic, which is einer oil achilas olam, or achilas kelev in the case of pure chometz, which could be used to make something else rise. The counter argument to that would be that every time you take a bite of bread, for instance, so the fat from the lipstick becomes like a little butter on the bread, and it becomes part of the food. If it wouldn't be kosher, there could be a problem that that itself is achshavit. It's impossible, really, to set general rules for inedible items. I'll tell you, every single one is a different case. There's no, you've got to study it from beginning to end. Is the item nifsal me'achila? Is the item bonded to the wood component or paper component? Is the item burnt up and has no more chomet? Is it like in the case of a glue, is it sort of lost and considered to be a kli? It lost its shem chomet, like the stuff in the with the wallpaper paste. Right? Because I'll talk about that. And they say that if it's there for 3 days, then it's no longer chomet. Afal pikein, chazal mishabech, the vinegar of women to try to scrape it off the walls and get rid of it. It shouldn't fall into the food. Is it the chablia that comes out from the keli, or is it something that will never come out? People bring rayas and prove that this little drop of this little film on the top of the tea surely must be because of the tarfus that's put in the styrofoam cup. The film is from the natural oils and tea. It only comes with tea and not with coffee. And it comes even in a China cup as well. Every single item in the inedible items has to be studied individually. there's no rule that could be used to govern even more than one case.
I think that in Mr. Shem, next year we're going to have Rabelski give an entire session just in the non-consumables. For those who are locked in, it's a pleasure to be with you. For those who have not been able to log in at this time, please tell your friends, associates, in Shul and elsewhere that this entire session will be posted on www.ou.org. It will also be posted on the special Pesach section of the OU Kosher website, which, just for your information, is filled with an enormous amount of Piskei Halacha, information relating to ingredients, to foods, to medicines, to food for the elderly. So please do go there and consult the extensive encyclopedic information that is available there for Pesach. Just a few moments ago, a question came in to Rabbi Farrell's email, to which you can still email for another few moments, farrelle@ou.org. Is there a minimum percentage of alcohol content for a wine that is to be used for Dalet Kosos? Rabelski?
Well, the Gemara says that Shosa Yayin Chai, it's Ein Boi Mishum Cheirus, Yidei Yayin Yosa, Yidei Cheirus Lo Yosa. What exactly is Yayin Chai? Yayin Chai is Yayin with a lot of alcohol, regular wine, but it's raw, meaning that it was undiluted. In those days, they didn't drink wine without diluting it. Probably the flavor was stronger, and it had to be diluted. Or at least that was the minhag, to dilute the wine. It could have been the same wine. There's something like cheres. It has to be wine that contains, makes you happy, makes you feel a little bit high, and good and excited. So pashtus has to be a certain amount of alcohol. But Paul Poiskim, throughout the Torah, said that if you have a wine which has no alcohol at all, a grape juice or raisin wine, which wasn't fermented, you're yoitza with the Dalet Kosos. It may not be the most mitzvah and amufcher to have cheres, but is there a minimum percentage of alcohol that will give you cheres as well? You have a wine lately that says yayin kal. Yes, yayin kal has about 3.5% alcohol. So I thought to myself, that's ideal. Because in the old days, when they put 3 parts of water to 1 part of wine, and the maximum amount of alcohol in wine is 14%. So if you end up having a quarter of 14%, so you have 3.5% alcohol. So it's not any less alcohol than the old days when they had dilution to the wine, you know, maziga. Today we hardly ever make maziga. It's not the habit of drinking. I'll tell you what it is. The reason is because in the old days, wine was the only drink around. Today we have coffee and tea and Pepsi Cola and Snapple and who knows, a million other things. So we don't need all that. So if we drink an occasional glass of wine, we could drink it with all the alcohol in it. So it gives us cheres even if it's undiluted. But whatever it is, 3.5% of alcohol is definitely within reason. Especially for a person who, for him, it's painful to drink wine, and he'll have the excitement of Yitzchus Mitzrayim and the Halal Vahidor, the joy of a Pesach Seder, only if it's a lower percentage. By all means, I just want to inject one last thing. The Rambam says that a person should have his wine prepared in a way which is suitable for the Das HaShoyser. Well, everybody has their own preference, and any kind of wine that makes a person feel in a joyous spirit, filled with cheres and shavuot vaydo to Hashem, by all means, he should take that cup.
I would add to Rabelski that there's hardly a place around the world where wine is produced, where there are vineyards and wine being produced, that there is no OU certified wine coming from that country. So, there's plenty of Das HaShoter around. Rav Schechter, not to get into any mother-in-law problems here, but one of our Haverim asked, if you're going to your in-laws for Pesach, what chumras of Pesach of yours and theirs do you and should keep?
I would assume one should observe the both chumras, whatever the in-laws are machmeran and whatever are machmeran as well. I think Rabbi Akiva Eger had Rabbi Akiva Eger and the Nesivis, they both had sons-in-law who were chassidim, who didn't want to eat kibroks. And they didn't, Rabbi Akiva Eger and the Nesivis both didn't observe kibroks when their sons-in-law were visiting by them, so they were nice enough not to give kibroks. So the story goes that at the end of Pesach, the son-in-law told the Nesivis, his father-in-law, he thanks him, he appreciates that he was so considerate, that he didn't force him to eat any gebroks on Pesach. He says, consider it, that's your punishment. You don't want any gebroks, we punish you, we don't give you gebroks. Yeah, or whatever. One should observe the both chumras.
And very much related to that, one of our chavarim asked, is there any reason bizman hazeh to avoid gebroks when it is not one's communal minhag?
You mean if maybe a family minhag? If one is from a Chassidish family, so one should continue his family minhag, unless he's converted, unless he joined the Misnagdim already. He's no longer a member of that family. Now he joined the Misnagdish family. Gibrox is sometimes a community minhag, and sometimes a family minhag. The different types of minhag.
I think what Rabbi Safran says was asking was if there's any real need to avoid having water touch the matzah, because perhaps there's, because of the way we bake our matzahs today, there's no raw flour that can turn into chametz. So it's only the minhag that drives us rather than the actual chashash. Yeah, what Rabbi Shechter said is definitely to the point. He spoke about the minhag. Yeah.
Back to some kashering of Belsky. I've noticed that there's quite a bit of machlok, as the gentleman asked, about whether it is mutter to kasher the grates on a stove top for Pesach. He cites a number of mainstream halacha books in English that have striking opinions. What is the correct psak?
The Ramo says in Siman Tofnan Aleph that chatzuvet zorech libud. Chatzuv is the grates, that's the tripod on which the pot rested. Shabur points out that really the grate doesn't have to be kashered. If you go to a tzeif in a hotel, you bring along your own pots, you could place it directly on the grate, even if there's a gas stove with a regular grate. Why? Because there's no belief that goes from the iron of the grate to the iron of the pot. If it has to have some liquid. So Mishabir says that the whole year we're not worried about it. But Mishabir to the Pischa, from Pesach we kasha the grate. He says though that we don't have to be machmir to have libun chomor, in other words, to make sure that it's red hot. It's enough just to have libun kal, pass it through a fire, but we don't have to bring it up to a temperature that gives sparks fly out from it. The Maisa is, today, the habits are a little bit different because the economic situation. When I was a youngster, there would be coal stoves that the apartment houses would have, and private houses would have a coal heating stove. And there would be a janitor who would be an expert. He had his pair of tons, and he made quite a bit of money. And there would be a lineup of people outside his house, and they would bring along the stove grates, and they would he would be lobbying them. Today, people buy new grates, and everyone has the money for it, and they sell them all over the place. So whatever one wants to do is fine.
I mentioned earlier that the webcast will be posted on OU Radio, both on the Kosher Tidbit site, as well as on the Pesach site. Those of you who are familiar with the ongoing OU Kosher educational programs know that we have recently completed over 100 tidbits, and that we now have these available on a disc that you can simply email to me, and we would be happy to mail to you for your continued learning and enjoyment. I recall that there was a very superb tidbit posted by Rav Schechter relating to issues of chinuch, of ketanim, of children, and so forth, that I urge you to listen to. Related to that is a question that was sent: at what age is a child required to participate in the Seder, and how should parents handle children that absolutely refuse to eat matzah? Rav Schechter?
What age should one try to explain? Even a very young child, if he can understand something, you don't have to explain everything to him. You should try to explain some of the basics. What age should a child eat matzah? Look, if it's, if eating the matzah is going to be if being machanech the child to eat the matzah before bar mitzvah is going to be counterproductive, he's going to hate the whole mitzvah. So then we don't insist on, we just explain to him that now you're not yet bar mitzvah, and another 3-4 years is going to be bar mitzvah, then you're going to have a mitzvah to eat the matzah. The basic chinuch min haTorah, there's a mitzvah of chinuch min haTorah. You have to tell the children when you'll become, right now you can eat all the chazah you want, you can eat mechal shabbos all you want, but another couple of years is going to be my mitzvah, then you have to observe all the dinim. That's the chinuch deraisa. Then there's the chinuch min derabbanan. You have to see to it that the child observes the mitzvahs now. So you have to be careful that the chinuch derabbanan shouldn't be counterproductive to ruin the chinuch deraisa. If the child is so stubborn, he refuses. Anish des nish, you just fulfill the chinuch deraisa.
I think if the continuing in that vein, that if the child refuses, I think the parents should probably have to go to someone else to be machanach them, because it seems that they might have mishandled the child. They need their own guidance.
Also recently posted, I believe, Kosher Tidbit 102 is an excellent summation of issues relating to Chometz Shavuot of a Pesach by our own Rabbi Luban. Related to that issue is a question that came in: how long must one wait before purchasing Chometz at a supermarket after Pesach, Rav Belsky?
It's very difficult. No one knows when the chametz that we find in the supermarket is surely from before Pesach, or even if the supermarket sold their chametz officially and there's a note in the window when the doorway attesting to that. They might have bought chametz on Pesach. I have an Arab store across from me, a grocery store, and they have deliveries made for them like every other store. The whole Pesach long and Yontif and Chalamoid, and the main distributors are Jewish companies. All the food they get, so there's nothing to be gained by buying chametz from the Arab. I think that for the first couple of weeks, a person should try to buy only the products that are made and distributed, by the way, by the Jewish companies. And after like Weimar or so, just a general rule of thumb. Pen, rye with the chametz in the supermarkets is not chametz Shavuot Pesach, and you could go with a rye. From that time, you're not required to be a vada, you'll never be a vada. But just about like Boyman time, based on the experience that we have with checking with the warehouses and with the suppliers and manufacturers and distributors. So it seems that by that time it will be arrived that the stuff that you get is not Chomer Shabbat Pesach.
We're going to continue until 4:15. Do be assured that all of the questions that have not been responded to here in person will be responded to via email. Obviously, many of you know, and if not, you should know, that there is an email to the Rebbe all year long that responds to questions coming from throughout the world relating to kashrus and other issues. We also can send the questions to myself or Rabbi Farrell. We will forward them to Rabbi Gerstin, to Rabbi Polsky, to the poskim when necessary, and we will be pleased and happy to respond to any and all questions. A question just came in just 2-3 minutes ago from Florida. Can sesame seeds be eaten for an Ashkenazi? What about Joyva sesame candy that says kosher lePesach, but the ingredients indicate corn syrup? Does it contain corn syrup, or do they not bother to change the ingredients list? Parenthetically, I don't believe that's an OU certified product. Ravelsky?
Sesame seeds are considered by everyone to be kidneys.
The Mishnah Berurah says there are a couple of levels of kidneys in the worst sesame seeds. I can't imagine that it should be made any worse because it has corn oil in it. Corn oil, which is probably the least chomer of all kidneys, since it's something that wasn't around at the time of the Rishonim. It only sort of is an adopted child in the list of kidneys grains. But sesame seeds, I just to be malamed tchus, I would assume that the whoever gave the hechsher and the destroyer is probably a Sephardi.
Rav Shechter, one of our chaverim received a question from a consumer. I do not keep any chometz on Pesach and do not bother with mechiras chometz. I get rid of all cakes, breads, etc., and do not need to worry about owning beverages, dairy, and meat products, soups, etc., as they are not real flour foods. I therefore keep these foods in my pantry during Pesach. Can one do this? Must one worry that foods that are not chometz be'en may pose a problem to own during Pesach due to their content, which may actually be derived from grain in minute quantities?
I would assume that many food products have grain in small percentages, and one should still go through a mechiras chometz just for that possibility. I don't think it's such a far-fetched possibility either, just for that possibility. Not all of the ingredients have to be mentioned on the label, according to the government. If it's less than 2%, it doesn't have to be mentioned on the list of ingredients. And if it's an ingredient that's mixed in on purpose, on Hilchas Pesach and Machmen, to say that it's not even batel b'shisha.
Very quickly, Rav Belsky, do you need to kasha dentures for Pesach, or is it considered like cheres?
Everybody wears their dentures for Pesach. I see people walking around without any teeth, and other people buy a special set of dentures for Pesach. But the meaning is just to wash them out very carefully, perhaps not to eat hot chometz for 24 hours before the Zman Hu Isser. But one of the reasons for this, because it's assumed that anything that enters the mouth becomes nimas and nifsal. Just like we say, that after 6 hours, even if there's meat, the Rambam says that between the teeth, others disagree, so it becomes nifsal. The mouth, the juices in the mouth, the enzymes that are created to consume and digest and destroy the food that's in it. So because of that, we're not machmir with dentures. But should wash them out carefully, and everybody should brush their teeth. Even people with natural teeth could still have all kinds of food clogged between their teeth, and they should be careful to clean it well.
Also related to kashering, is it possible to kasher a convection oven for Pesach? The gentleman writes, oven is a KitchenAid standard size oven with a range on top. The convection oven has a fan and vent which cannot be reached for cleaning. Rabelsky.
Well, you know, years ago, almost nobody kashered ovens for Pesach. People had these little ovens that they inserted into the big oven, and whatever cakes they were able to bake, they baked inside the oven insert. Since that time, two things happened. One, there was self-cleaning stoves, which reached 900 degrees Fahrenheit, which burnt everything inside, even polymerized materials, which was as hard as a rock, it became a plastic. They were also destroyed by the high heat in the self-cleaning oven. Because of that, people were able to use the oven. And contrary to the way it was 40, 50 years ago, more recent Paiskim began to discover reasons why all you have to do is turn on the stove for a couple of hours. In those days, Moshe Zatzal would very often mention in this, at the end of Shabbos HaGodol Drasha, that people should not settle for keeping the stove on for a couple of hours. Others disagreed with their Moshe, but generally accepted that you can. A convection oven, it has a special problem. because the fan and the whole system doesn't allow for very high temperatures. Your parts are more sensitive, and it would be destroyed if you would have very high temperatures. But a person could get a propane torch and burn the sides of the convection oven. By the way, the government considers that to be a very, very unsafe thing, and if a person does that in a public cooking place, in a restaurant or any other place, they might get arrested for endangering the population. So I think if someone has a convection oven, unless he wants to go through a very careful and slow, patient cleaning over each spot with a torch, or perhaps remove the fan parts, which are sensitive, have some mechanic do it for him, and make the fire very, very hot. Put some charcoal in the stove if he does that. It's all extremely complicated, and it's not practical. The way to do it, if someone has a convection oven, would be to either not to use the oven or to get an insert. You could find some type of piece to be placed on top of the stove, which has an oven for those who have to have an oven with an interior which needs baking. You could have these old cholent ovens like these that have a shelf in it, bake your cake. Whatever one does, it's koshering an ordinary convection oven. It's too difficult and painstaking to do a good job, and it should be avoided.
I'm going to close with a more of a hashkafa shaila that was asked as to whether it's appropriate to run out right after Pesach is over to wait online for several hours and buy pizza from the pizza store. Rav Schechter?
I think they quote in the name of the Vilna Gaon that on Matzoy Pesach he used to make Havdalah over beer. Because he wanted to demonstrate that he was observing these chametz only because of Pesach, not because he doesn't like it. And the pasuk says by the nazir, after he brings all the korbanos, v'acha yishta hanazir yayin. So some say, adarav, he should dafke drink wine to demonstrate. I don't know if it's right to wait online for a couple of hours. I don't know. But an inyan of eating chametz after Pesach is over is an inyan to demonstrate that you're abstaining from chametz during the duration of Pesach was l'shem mitzvah.
A very, very big yisher koch to our poskim, our geonim, Rav Velsky and Rav Schechter, for the very, very enlightening session. I hope all who were logged in were able to learn so very, very much that was offered. Again, for those who were not able to log in, the program in its entirety will be offered both on the Kosher Tidbits and on the Pesach section of the OU website. We wish all of Klal Yisrael, all of our listeners, Chakosher V'Sameach. May we be zoche indeed this Chodesh Nisan to be nigol kmo shenigolu avaseinu v'mitzrayim.
And to be makriv the Korban Pesach in Yerushalayim.
And to be makriv the Korban Pesach v'Yerushalayim v'Yerushalayim v'Yerushalayim. Kol tov, all the very, very best. Thank you.